My name again is Michael Yonker, and I'm studying towards a PhD here at Andrews University. And I have a very challenging topic. There is no pretending that it's not. With its many connections to many other issues in Christian theology, there is a tremendous amount of humility that one has to have when touching on the issues of foreknowledge and freedom and the relationship to theodicy, a satisfying theodicy. There's no doubt about it that the burden is on me, given the story of history, to offer something new. And I'm going to try and do that because, to put it very simply, I'm not satisfied with all of the solutions that are out there. Trying to make foreknowledge and freedom compatible. Of course, the last 20, 30 years with open theism has been to possibly deny it, so to remove the problem. I'm not satisfied with that either in the good Arminian Adventist tradition. So I'm going to be trying to, but I'm not satisfied with many classic Arminian proposals either, as I'll share a little bit. So I'm going to try and articulate a new reason to think about the problem in a different way, so that the challenge is on me, and I know that. And you know that a problem is a real problem, as my paper, which I'm not sharing, but I will read just the introduction to it. You know a problem is a real problem when the poets write about it. This is no longer just a mathematical, philosophical puzzle, but John Milton, amongst others, and also my favorite of late, Thomas Campbell, a Scottish poet and amateur theologian in 1794, wrote, "Yet whence methinks repining mortal cries, if heaven be good, can human ill arise? Man's feeble race, what countless ills await, ills self-created, ills ordained by fate." Further unraveling the mortal's cry, he asks, "If final good be God's eternal plan, why is the power of ill bestowed on man?" Fortunately, Campbell satisfyingly suggests an answer. An ample liberty of choice is given. Man chooses ill. Where is the fault of heaven? Unfortunately, the poem doesn't neatly and tidily conclude with a celebration of the liberty of choice granted to humanity. By the way, where is the PowerPoint? I was trying to show it. Sorry, Jonathan. How's this machine work? I'll continue reading. Campbell then discovers, nestled within the core of this apparent solution, a conundrum yet deeper still. Though you reply, "Ample freedom's mine, the fault of evil still is half divine. If heaven foresaw that, from the scope of choice, perversion, vice, and misery should rise." Full circle then have we come and must again inquire, "Whence, monster vice, originates thy course? Art thou from God? Is purity thy source?" The first line of Campbell's posited answer to the challenge is not an invitational suggestion bereft of ponderance. "Ask not, 'tis answered, arrogantly blind, to scan the secrets of the eternal mind." This is a intuitive puzzle granted us as Christian philosophers, an extremely challenging one. And as I said, due to its relationship to theodicy and evil and discussions on those issues, it is not one that we can trivialize or treat lightly. And yet, without dealing with the theodical implications directly, I just want to focus in a little bit on the logic. But having done that, having attacked the logic behind how we look at this problem, I haven't forgotten that it is a very serious issue in theology. A tentative proposal for a problem in common, logic in Arminianism and Adventism within the context of divine foreknowledge and human freedom. An outline of my presentation will be a brief historical flyby on a very old problem, foreknowledge, freedom, and logic, that predates Christianity, which is of significance. So we're then going to look a little bit at what is logic. And we're going to look a little bit at its roots very quickly and why it has developed the way that it has, Aristotelian logic and mathematical, symbolic logic and so forth, some heavy topics, and I'm going to be going over them very quickly. And what have logic, theology, and reality to do with each other? Sometimes it's easy to break these different areas down into sort of different subsections. Logic, theology, and reality. We can discuss logic in kind of its own field. You don't have to be a theologian to discuss logic and what makes it what it is and so forth, etc. And then I will be moving on to a little bit of the integration of some disciplines that are sometimes at odds or considered to be at odds, but lately are becoming less and less so, and that's just the way it is. So if you're into the contemporary cutting-edge discussions, welcome to the new world. And farewell, classical world. We barely knew ye. And I will be giving a new definition of the word paradox. An old problem. Augustine, I have a deep desire to know how it can be that God knows all things beforehand and that, nevertheless, we do not sin by necessity. Since God foreknew that man would sin, that which God foreknew must necessarily come to pass. How, then, is the will free when there is apparently this unavoidable necessity? It's a very challenging problem, stated bluntly at the dawn of Christianity. And guess what? This question hasn't gone anywhere. There are some different options. This is not a presentation on historical theology, so you're not going to get the full details of the subtleties and nuances of these positions, but I'm going to quickly give the basic positions that most folks fall into. There is Calvinism, which is, of course, known for its hardline double predestination. You can search up those statements by Calvin that definitely make it sound like he doesn't really care if some of us are, well, destined for the tough luck scenario. Also, along Calvinist streams, you'll find a lot of folks advocating, along the traditions of Luis de Molina, a middle knowledge, which, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most, still makes sin arguably unavoidable. What middle knowledge is saying, very briefly, for those of you that are not well-versed in these new or strange and very complex ideas, is that God surveyed all of the possible worlds that he could create before creating the world that actually came to be, the actual world. In surveying all of these possible worlds, he concluded that there was no possible world where free creatures wouldn't eventually sin, and therefore he is not the cause of that eventual sin, that free-willed sin, if he chose to create this any one of these worlds. So the fact that God created any world meant that basically sin was inevitable. Some Molinists try and wrestle with that language, but I am not persuaded by any of their efforts to get around the fact that sin still seems to be arguably unavoidable. Of course, open theism is the latest rage. The last 30 years, since the early 1980s, 1994, The Openness of God, the big landmark book that in many ways did shake the foundations of particularly American Protestantism and evangelicalism, and there's a fascinating history behind that. But basically, open theism says, guess what? There's no problem. Rather than resolve the problem, it dissolves the problem by saying there is no problem. There is no exhaustively definite foreknowledge. Now, speaking to an Armenian and Adventist conference, I want to touch on one point that is often mistakenly viewed concerning open theism, and that is that it doesn't necessarily deny foreknowledge or near foreknowledge because God can still know a knowledge of all possibilities. This is sometimes neglected. I'm still not satisfied by this, but nevertheless, depending on what kind of open theist you are, you can massage the language to come up with something close to foreknowledge. Very close, just not quite, because we can't have God responsible for it, and so he can't know the future. And then, of course, the Armenianist position. Some Armenians actually do adopt various forms of middle knowledge, and there are some very complicated nuances there, but to separate how they are different from Calvinists, but basically it ultimately ends up being somewhat the same. They're just more Armenian in perhaps other areas of theology or other areas of that Arminius touched on versus Calvin. The big Armenianist position is to advocate a simple or passive foreknowledge, which is, again, the opposite of God foreordaining things in Calvinism. In Armenianism, Armenianists want to insist that God foreknows the future, but it's a passive, non-causative knowing. And that some have called it, like Michael Robinson, a conditional will actual foreknowledge model, which he himself acknowledges is in some ways similar to open theism, except that he wants to force the language into a scenario where God can know this future without it being causative. In his case, and in most others' cases, the way that they ultimately get around to doing this is to suggest that God is timeless rather than temporal, which is the big catchword phrase in open view of God, open theism. that God is timeless, therefore, you know, his knowledge exists in another realm, so he could passively know it and not be causative. I am still not persuaded, as I've mentioned, by their wrestling and nuancing of the language. I think it's half-baked, and yet I do lean towards it, if you want to know my personal opinions. Now, there is a couple of other alternatives. One is William of Ockham, Ockhamism and temporal foreknowledge. Unfortunately, although there are a few folks, the most vigorous of being N.Q. Song, a 2002 dissertation, where he tries to very eloquently argue for a defense of Ockhamism and foreknowledge and freedom. But the fact that Ockham himself, the founder of this view, stated that I maintain that it is impossible to express clearly the way in which God knows future contingents. Nevertheless, it must be held so, but that he does, must be held that he does so, but contingently, is effectively a nail in the coffin to his opponents. There's no way you can get around arguing over the logical subtleties if you're going to admit that it's impossible. William Hasker, a well-known open theist, you'll find in his introduction to his 1989 book, God and the Nature of God, Time, God and Time, that you know, he just considers that nonsense. He pretty much annihilates Ockhamism and does so fairly effectively, in my opinion. So options to the problem thus far. We have, does Ockhamism succeed? It's hard to say yes. If you're going to argue for Ockhamism as it's commonly presented, you're going to have a lot of trouble because it relies on a lot of hard to argue for presuppositions. How does God's knowledge relate to his temporality? How does it relate to a host of other factors? And thus far, I am not convinced that it works, and neither are the open theists nor the Calvinists, might I add. So you've got, remember, three different camps. By the way, I want to recommend a couple of other good summary works if you're just getting into these issues a little bit. Terence Teason's is a good, balanced, multi-view book that also takes a position. And also the latest one, which I'll come back to a little bit later, Garrett Deweese's God and the Nature of Time, which is a key work to get into some of the heavier issues that I'll be getting into in a moment. Now, this is an old problem, as I said. It's not just restricted to Augustine. It is not unique to theology either. The problematic relationship between logic and causal determinism was clearly seen in Parmenides, a 5th century BC Greek philosopher, and his student Zeno of Elea, and is also viewed in Aristotle's Sea Battle, which I'll come back to in a moment. But first, logic. This is a quotation from C.S. Lewis, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is a series that I'm actually quite fond of. And there's a passage in there. And if you've read the book, this makes a lot more sense. I'll give a very brief summary of it. But logic, says the professor half to himself. Why don't they teach logic at these schools? There are only three possibilities. And this, the background of this story is that there was a young girl, Lucy, who in this fantasy allegory of C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, has stepped into a wardrobe and been magically transported into another world which has its own rules. It operates under a different timeline. Time operates differently, and a host of other things that make it a radically exciting, fun, and not always children-friendly world to live in. But it is nevertheless a fun story. But upon coming back, and she also had a rather devious, dishonest brother named Edmund, who on her second trip in joined her. But because Edmund was rather contrary of a fellow, when they both came out, Lucy and her brother Edmund, and confronted their other siblings, and later the gentleman that they were staying with, a family friend, a professor, Edmund lied about it and set Lucy up for a very embarrassing situation where she was forced to tell the truth that she had been to this radically wild, weird, exciting world, but that time didn't relate the way that they thought it should. She was gone there for several hours. When she came back, she was worried that the professor and her other older brother and sister would be worried about her because she'd been gone so long. And they said, "What? You didn't leave. You were only gone about 30 seconds, you know. So what's the problem?" So they talked to the older siblings, talked to the professor about it, Peter and Susan. And the professor says, "Logic," as the older siblings are trying to decide how to respond to their deranged or seemingly deranged younger sister. "Logic," says the professor half to himself. "Why don't they teach logic at these schools? There are only three possibilities. Either your sister is telling lies, or she is mad, or she is telling the truth. You know that she doesn't tell lies from your history with her, and it is obvious that she is not mad. For the moment, then, and unless any further evidence turns up, we must assume that she is telling the truth. Susan, the older sister, looked at him very hard and was quite sure from the expression on his face that he was not making fun of them. And there is a lesson to draw from that, the bottom point here. Our conclusion of the professor's question, what is true is logical and irrelevant of the allegory and the story. I hope you can see the truth in that statement. If it's true, it is logical. An important point. Logic is, put very simply, to study logic is to study argument. Argument is the stuff of logic. Above all, a logician is someone who worries about arguments. But surely it must be more than that alone. We all know how to argue, I hope. Maybe not. Maybe hopefully not. Thus, put in a more technical way, logic is the science of necessary inference, validity, and truth, which leads us into a host of extremely complex language that if you don't have a degree in philosophy and logic and mathematics, most of us are hapless to fully appreciate what they're wasting their time over. The central problem which worries the logician is just this. How, in general, can we tell good arguments from bad arguments? All right, so that is the introduction to what logic is. Now, very briefly over history, you are probably familiar with Aristotelian syllogisms. This was a very common form and basically dominated a lot of discussions on logic for basically 2,000 years. So it is important to have gone over it again very briefly. You have three different lines here. You have a major premise, all men are mortal, a minor premise, Socrates is a man. Conclusion, Socrates is mortal. Not hard to substitute, by the way, is it, with the major premise, and there's some issues with this, but nevertheless, for the moment, let it fly. God has foreknowledge, minor premise, what is foreknown is certain, conclusion, what is certain is not free. I mean, after all, it makes sense, right? There's Augustine at work again. Of course, logic takes many other forms, which I can only give you a small taste of. Of course, mathematics, 2 plus 6 equals 8. You can look at that puzzle and ask yourself, how could that not be true, or why is it true? And you'll find a lot of interesting thoughts that go on. I mean, after all, are numbers, what are they? What are numbers? But that's a very complex issue. We have laws, like A equals A, the law of identity. If something is, then it is that, right? It can't be something else. If something is an A, or the table is a table, then the table is a table is a table. We also have A cannot be something else. A cannot be B, the law of non-contradiction. And also, there is a very interesting law that is often and sometimes in error taken for granted, and that is the law of the excluded middle, that all propositions must be either true or not true. And we could, so if something is, then it is, and if it's not, then it's not. But we'll come back to that one in a bit. But logic can be tricky, especially when we talk about time and freedom. Back to the syllogisms very quickly, though, and the reason why you have to be reading carefully when you read any book or any text dealing with logic is it's very easy for errors to creep in. Let's say, again, if every man is mortal and Socrates is a man, then Socrates is mortal. Therefore, if nothing is better than eternal happiness and a cheese sandwich is better than nothing, then a cheese sandwich is better than eternal happiness. Now, you may just grimace and say, why did he insert that ridiculous line? Of course, we know that a cheese sandwich is not better than eternal happiness. However, and as someone, as I note there, that inclines themselves towards veganism, I reject that. If some of you want to, have another view, well, I'll leave you up to that. But however, it is not always so simple. That one may be silly, and we can say, well, that's a logical fallacy. You've misused the concepts, words of meaning, and you've just totally botched it. But it is not always that simple. It is not always that simple. Let's go back to Parmenides and his student Zeno of Elea, and Aristotle. There is a famous arrow paradox of motion. Maybe